Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Lowy Institute. My name is Anthony Bubalo, and I'm the research director here at the Institute. We're delighted today to welcome back an old friend of the Institute, and indeed one of our board members, Ambassador Martin Indyk. We're now rapidly approaching the last year of the Obama presidency, 8 years of Obama administration, of Obama presidency, and we thought it would be a great opportunity to chat with Martin about a bit about the Obama legacy, but also in particular to look forward at the issues that are likely to dominate the presidential campaign, the foreign policy issues that are likely to dominate the presidential campaign, as well as the issues that are likely to land on the president's desk the first day that he or she sits down at that desk. The campaign is starting to kind of gear up. Both sides are looking to choose their candidates. On the Democrat side, you've got a couple of candidates. On the Republican side, you have about 257.
256, actually.
256, yes, one's pulled out now. So we have no better person to talk about these issues than Ambassador Indyk. Martin has had many careers. He started out as an Australian academic and then an Australian intelligence analyst, went to the US, was a think tank entrepreneur, became a US citizen, worked in the National Security Council, worked as a national security advisor under the Clinton administration, was ambassador to Israel twice, was a senior State Department official, was moved across to Brookings, where he's now the executive vice president. In that time, he also fit in a bit of peace envoying for the Obama administration. So there's no better person to take us through the ins and outs of both the current administration and also the challenges that the future administrations will face. So please join me in welcoming Ambassador Martin Indyk. I want to start with the Obama administration, Martin. How would you characterize the administration's approach to foreign policy, and how has the administration gone? I mean, how has that worked out for Obama, for America, and for the world?
Well, first of all, thank you. Thanks for having me back. It's great to be back here at the Lowy Institute. I'm very proud to have had the opportunity to work with Frank Lowy, and thank you, Frank, for coming today, and Peter and David and Stephen and all of you, and Michael Fullilove, who unfortunately is in Beijing doing his Boyle lecture today. But it's really great to see how the Lowy Institute has grown and become the authoritative place for discussion of international policy here in Australia, and to the point where everybody I know that comes to Australia wants to speak at the Lowy Institute. So I'm glad that you found a little space for me still. So I think that it's important to understand that President Obama may have come into office with a kind of unclear idea of how he was going to translate his progressive politics into a foreign policy agenda. And he, of course, was kind of overwhelmed in his early years by the financial collapse and the Great Recession and wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. So I think it took him quite a while. But now that he's in his seventh year, we see much more clearly how he's come to terms with the challenges of applying a progressive ambition to the realities of the world today. And the best expression of that that I can refer you to is something that hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but I think really expresses it very well. And that is a document that the administration puts out every 2 years and put out at the beginning of this year. It's called the National Security Strategy. You can find it on the White House website. And that really outlined his strategy for his overall national security policy. And the essence of that was to say to the American people, we need to move from hard power to smart power. What did he mean by that? Is that he wanted to get away from the mindset which he feels has led America astray far too often, that every problem has a military solution. And the way to solve problems internationally is to send the army in. And he's coming off the experience of the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was against the Iraq war at the time. And so he, part of that was a determination to end wars in the Middle East and not start new ones. But he's now put this into a broader national security strategy, which is designed to focus on what you might call the kind of global issues, counter-terrorism, non-proliferation, doing something about climate change, pandemics, the kind of challenges which cross national boundaries and require solutions that sometimes will involve the military, but certainly not as a first resort. And so that is, I think, the heart of what he's been trying to do. That is why, for example, he has put so much emphasis, spent so much political capital on this nuclear deal with Iran. I gather not so controversial here, but hugely controversial in the United States. But that fits very well within his overall approach with this emphasis on non-proliferation. Now, the interesting thing about this is that you see the other powers in the world understanding this and finding ways to actually cooperate with Obama on this agenda while engaging in the old-style geopolitical revisionism that he's trying to get away from. In a sense, I think, trying to buy the United States off with cooperation in these areas. So, for example, Xi Jinping in Washington today or tomorrow after the Pope leaves. And by the way, the Pope's agenda is very much fits with the President's agenda, which is why Obama was there at the airport to greet him, huge event on the South Lawn. You know, he fits with that. Of course, the Pope doesn't have an army, so smart power makes a lot of sense for the Pope. But Xi Jinping does, and it's a growing army. And, of course, it's being used to assert Chinese interests in the South China Sea. But where the tension is growing on that front, which is the old geopolitical style hard power rivalry, Xi Jinping is cooperating with Obama in the first instance on climate change. And now we're going to have a cybersecurity agreement come out of this, where they will agree not to threaten each other's cyber infrastructure. All of that fits very much with Obama's progressive agenda. But in terms of doing something about the hard power issues, you know, the Chinese clearly are not at this stage at least deterred. And of course, we have the same thing with the Russians. What, you know, Putin goes in, takes over Crimea, moves into eastern Ukraine. You know, a very clear geopolitical push to expand Russian sphere of influence, according to Soviet mindset. But that's on the one hand. On the other hand, full cooperation with Obama in the negotiations with the Iranians over this nuclear deal. Mm. And now, what is Putin saying about his move into Syria? Well, that's counterterrorism. That's to help Obama fight ISIS. And indeed, I think part of Putin's calculation is that, you know, we can play to Obama's interest in smart power here and divert him from the problems of the Ukraine. And so finally, in this, you've got Iran. And Iran is another very good example of this. Do a deal with the United States on non-proliferation, And in the meantime, do, you know, as much as you can to promote your dominance in strict geopolitical terms in the Middle East and keep the two separate and play to Obama's interest on the one hand on the nuclear deal and avoid any constraints on Iran's nefarious destabilizing activities in the region.
It's very clear that that shift from hard to smart power reflects Obama's outlook in part, but how much does it also reflect the situation that the United States finds itself in? I mean, it's not just a shift from hard power to smart power, it's also to cheap, slightly cheaper power. And how much, you know, we hear a lot of big talk from, you know, some of the Republican candidates in particular about how they will, you know, from Donald Trump, how they'll make America win again. But how much will those realities constrain even a future U.S. President, the reality of shrinking resources and a shrinking military and a more limited capacity to play that fully expansive role that perhaps the U.S. has played in the past?
I actually don't think we're going to see any further decreases in defense spending. I think that whoever becomes president will actually increase the defense budget. We still have the largest defense budget by far in the world. We have the largest armed forces by far in the world. And I think there's a very strong urge to maintain that. But in terms of its deployment, I think that while the job is not complete, I think Obama has played to a sentiment in the American public, which crudely could be described as isolationist, but I don't think that really describes it. It really is a disillusionment with the notion that the United States can move into a country, topple a leader, and rebuild, do nation building according to democratic norms, and somehow everything will be okay. I don't think across the partisan spectrum, I do not believe there is a support for that anymore. That is the consequence of George W. Bush's folly in Iraq. And so while the American people will certainly support robust military action against ISIS or terrorist operations, they won't support sending troops into Iraq again. They just don't believe in that anymore. So Obama has, I think, touched on something there that will continue. You do not see Republican presidential candidates calling for putting troops on the ground in the Middle East. In fact, they say the opposite. Oh, we're going to, you know, embed some special forces or something, but we're not going to put boots on the ground, because they know that that's not popular. And the only Republican who's pushing for that is John McCain. He's not running for president.
Is that public sentiment capable of shifting, though, if, you know, as you say, Americans support the defeat of Islamic State, if it becomes, as it seems to be becoming more obvious, that you can't actually do that without putting some boots on the ground, whether those boots are special forces boots or you know, infantry boots, is it possible that ground will shift again to maybe not the assertiveness of a Bush presidency, but something, you know, somewhere in the middle between a Bush and an Obama approach?
Well, you know, God forbid it, but we may well see it in the context of a presidential campaign. Imagine if there is an ISIS attack on the American homeland in the next 12, 13 months. All of the candidates are going to have to respond to that, and there will be a kind of gung-ho, let's go get them attitude. So it's very hard to know how an incident like that could change things. I'm not sure it's going to happen, famous last words, because ISIS is much more concerned. Unlike al-Qaeda, ISIS is much more concerned about building its state, its caliphate in the region, rather than attacking the infidel in its homeland.
Yep.
But, you know, who knows what they're actually planning. So I think it is kind of scenario dependent, because we have this massive force. It's just the notion that we can go in and fix things has taken a body blow.
Yeah.
And so I think there will be a reluctance to do that. Now, the problem with dealing with ISIS, which is what we're up against, is there are nobody else's boots on the ground to do the job. The Turks want to fight the Kurds, they don't want to fight ISIS. The Saudis want to fight the Yemenis, the Houthis, they don't want to fight ISIS. So, you know, the Iranians want to fight ISIS, but we don't want Shia militias taking control of Sunni areas because then we'll have a huge sectarian explosion. So it means that we don't have a plausible or effective strategy against ISIS other than to kind of put pressure on them and try to contain them. But I think we're at the point now where all the talking points are, you know, it's going to take years, it's going to be a long time. And that's just a different way of saying we're not going to go in and finish the job with our forces.
Yeah. Thinking about next year, the presidential campaign, it's the kind of the old truism that foreign policy doesn't generally decide US presidential elections. But looking from what we can tell now, what do you think are going to be the big issues that the candidates from both sides are really going to focus on, that are going to be the focus of debate?
Well, if you look at Hillary Clinton, who remains by far the most likely Democratic candidate to get the nomination on the Democratic side, her big focus is on the middle class and trying to address the concerns of the middle class that have suffered from essentially a lowering of their standard of living over the last 10 years. So she's very domestically focused. She did give a foreign policy speech 2 weeks ago at the Brookings Institution, which was staking out a position in support of Obama's Iran deal, but making clear that it was a yes and speech. Yes, we should support the deal and implement a more robust strategy for dealing with Iran's destabilizing activity in the region. And that was her attitude when she was Secretary of State too. She wanted a more robust engagement in Syria, and that's in her speech as well, and a whole lot of other tactical approaches designed to basically step up the pressure on ISIS and Assad. And so I think that's part of what she wants to do, is to inoculate herself from the Republican charge, which is an old sore, that is, you know, the Democrats are weak and feckless when it comes to foreign policy. And that is the charge that they make, all of them make, of Obama, citing, of course, Exhibit A, which is, you know, he declared a red line in Syria and then didn't enforce it. So I think at this point, it's more about who looks tough and who looks weak. Foreign policy is a kind of litmus test for your strength or weakness, rather than any particular issue. So what do we do about Putin? Well, we've got to stand up to him. What do we do about ISIS? We've got to defeat them. You know? But when it comes down to the specifics of what they would actually do, it's not a lot of detail, especially not from the Republican front runner, Donald Trump, who just promises that he'll get a better deal. But he doesn't say anything else. And one thing that's interesting about Donald Trump, unlike Ted Cruz, another of the Republican candidates, he does not say he will tear up the Iran nuclear deal. This is a terrible deal. You know, Kerry really was a failed negotiator. I would have done much better. I'll put in people who can do much better. But we'll need to consider. We'll need to look and consider what we do with the new.
Just on that point, is it realistic that any future president will tear up the Iran deal?
No, I don't believe so. We shall see. But I do think that it's possible for a future president to re-engage with Iran about some of the terms of the deal. Now, don't forget that assuming that Iran fulfills its obligations under the deal, which has a strong incentive to do because then it gets the sanctions lifted, it will have implemented its part of the deal, taking down its nuclear material stockpile, allowing inspectors to come in, reconfiguring the plant at the nuclear or the plutonium plant at Iraq, and shutting down the Fordow centrifuges. I think it will have done all of that by January, February of next year. In other words, during Obama's term, and the sanctions will then be lifted. So that's the world that the next president is going to inherit, one in which the deal is being implemented. So I don't think that it had become possible to renegotiate that basic, the outlines of the deal. But in terms of what happens in 15 years, what happens in the out years, what kind of behavior the United States will respond to, even with military force, and by the way, Hillary Clinton was very specific about that in a way that Obama was not willing to be, making clear that if she sees any indication that they try to go for a nuclear weapon, she will use force. But there, you know, there are ways in which quietly a new president could engage the Iranians and start to lay down some new red lines and about what behavior is acceptable and what is not, and even potentially, you know, try to negotiate a longer time frame.
Yeah.
So I think that's possible. But yeah, I remember very clearly from another part of the region, Ariel Sharon, when he became Prime Minister of Israel, and he'd been such a hardliner on everything, so critical of previous governments. And when he came into office, he said, you know, it looks different from here. Mm. And that's just the reality. Once you're in, how are you going to tear it? If you're Ted Cruz, how are you going to tear up that nuclear agreement? What exactly are you going to do? Mm. Are you going to try to impose sanctions? Well, good luck with that, because on what basis would you do that? None of the other parties to the multilateral sanctions are going to join you unless the Iranians are not fulfilling their part of the deal. And if you rip it up, you give the Iranians their home free. They have no obligations then and can go back to moving to, you know, a capability that's 3 months from a nuclear bomb, which is where they are today. So I'd be really dumbfounded if any presidential candidate would, president-elect would actually tear up the deal.
In looking at the next president and looking at the issues that they're going to have to deal with, and again, it's a year is a very long time in international policy. You don't know what things may crop up. But one of the things that's guaranteed that the new president will have to deal with is one old world problem, which is Putin's Russia, and one new world problem, which is Xi's China. Do you see what scope do you see for dramatically different approaches, whether it's a Democrat president or Republican president, in how they deal with those two problems, or is it going to be more something more subtle?
It's very hard to know at the moment, because the debate has not really been joined in any serious way. There is a serious Republican debate, but it's not about serious issues. You know, Donald Trump has turned it into a reality show and trivialized the policy debate. That won't continue. At a certain point, the American voters are going to want the candidates to lay out their positions in detail on the issues of the day, which will include policy towards Russia and policy towards China and policy towards Iran and the Middle East. I think that, as I said before, the Republicans will position themselves as tougher on Putin and tougher on Xi and China, whether it's whether it's cybersecurity issues or whether it's South China Sea or whether it's Ukraine. I think that there'll be a sense that we need to be tougher with them. What exactly that means, more sanctions on Putin's Russia over the Ukraine, is entirely possible. Would we arm the Ukrainians with offensive weapons? I don't know, but that's a route that's certainly up for debate in Washington. Question of what do we do about ISIS will be a subject of hotly debated, although, as I said before, I do not believe that you're going to see anybody advocating for putting US troops on the ground. Precisely because Obama has presented himself, and purposely now, as the progressive, as the liberal, as the one who is trying to approach international affairs in what his critics would call a kumbaya policy, they're going to stake out a position to the right of them, including Hillary Clinton. So I think that's what you're going to see, and I think that's what will end up. The next president will have a tougher policy on these issues. Will they shift on the kind of things that he's talking about? No, but I think they're going to do both more equally than placing the emphasis where he has at the moment.
One of the things that obviously concerns Australia and Australian policymakers is the amount of attention that the future US president pays to our own region, to Asia. Now, to a certain degree, the rise of China forces any US administration to do that. But we've seen with the Obama administration that the so-called pivot or rebalance, and there's lots of debate about how well that's actually been executed, how much pivoting has there been. Do you see... I mean, certainly, if it's a Hillary presidency, you're more likely to see a continuation, given the origins of that policy with her as Secretary of State. But what about the Republicans? What about that? And what about that general sense in America of understanding of what's happening in Asia and a recognition that in future that's where the terms of global competition are going to be set?
I think that there's a consensus. That this century is an Asian century, and that America needs that the pivot or the rebalancing was logical. I think it really had bipartisan support, and it manifests itself in strategic terms in the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is this new trade agreement which will link not just the major economies of Asia, and I would imagine that there's now debate about that China would be invited eventually to join. But it also links the Pacific states of Latin America and Mexico. It's a big strategic play. And what's interesting about it is that it was made possible by a rare bipartisan support, or actually, let me correct that, was made possible by rare Republican support for Obama to give him fast-track authority to negotiate these trade agreements against the will of the left wing of his own Democratic Party. But he was able to get it through on Republican votes. So I think that gives you the sense of where the Republicans will be on free trade issues. They're very strong. And so if you see TPP as a strategic move, which I really think it is, then you're going to see that continue. Hillary also, notwithstanding the vulnerability that she has on the left wing, and you see that with Senator Sanders, garnering support on the left, nevertheless she took a stand in support of the trade pact. Similarly with the rebalancing in terms of greater military focus here. I know that Australia and Singapore tend to be like skeptical of this, but in fact there's a serious shift underway in terms of putting military resources into this region and adopting a more robust position. And don't forget, Hillary Clinton took a very strong stand against Chinese assertiveness in the South China Sea. That was the original part of the pivot. And so I think she and the Republicans will find common ground on that one as well. So I do, and of course we haven't discussed India. And hard on the heels of the Pope and Xi Jinping comes Modi. and the Indian Prime Minister and President Obama have an excellent relationship. There's a real sense of common interest now. I think under Modi, the Indians are kind of shirking their kind of hang up about playing a geopolitical role, clearly bolstering the relationship between the United States and India, helps to balance China in the region. And that is, I believe, that will be part of Obama's legacy that will be supported by Republican or Democratic presidents that come after him.
There'll also have to be quite a re-education of say the foreign policy kind of elites, in the sense that, you know, we've had a generation of, whether it's think tankers, officials, journalists, that are really steeped in American policy in the Middle East, and which is great for people like us, but there are the, you know, we released a paper today looking at Congress and the pivot. And one of the important, by our, one of our research fellows, Aaron Connolly, one of the important observations he makes is that you know, there's really been a hollowing out of Congresses, of the people in Congress who really knew Asian issues and understand Asian issues. How much of an impact will that have, you know, in terms of providing that intellectual background for shifting American focus?
It's a good question, because not only is there a hollowing out in Congress, there's also a hollowing out in terms of policy experts. That's quite clear now in terms of the shift from the, you know, the greats who dealt with China, who've now all migrated to the Brookings Institution, people like Jeff Bader and Ken Lieberthal and so on, and the next generation isn't really there. And so yes, there's that kind of challenge, but I think that they'll catch up. It's a big country, a lot of talent, but it's good to highlight it. And it's interesting that you've got a scholar who's doing it, because there are study groups in the States amongst foreign policy experts who always get together at this time when a presidential election takes place. I know of two study groups who are actually focusing on this question of lack of capability when it comes to, lack of capacity when it comes to expertise in this area. But I want to make a broader point, which is that I do think that part of the consequence of the way in which politics in Washington have become so polarized and so dysfunctional is that there's a movement to the extremes in foreign policy as well. I hope that this presidential debate, when we actually get into serious substantive policy debate, will be an opportunity for the center to assert itself, that is to say the center left and the center right, where I think there is a lot of common ground about what the United States should be doing, and which is really a combination of hard power and smart power, which is what I was suggesting before.
Yeah. Well, of course, when you go back to the United States, and if they're struggling for Asia expertise, you know that the phone number of the Lowy Institute, we've got plenty around the house. I'll now like to open questions to the floor. As is normally the case, raise your hand, wait for the microphone, and tell us who you are. And as I'm sure there'll be a lot of questions, please keep it to a question, to a short question, if possible. So any questions? Just down here.
My name is Ben Scott. Martin, you made the case very persuasively that the next US administration would adopt more assertive policies in different places around the world. I'm interested in hearing your thoughts more on what a more assertive strategy would look like, how those policies would be linked, especially in somewhere as complex as the Middle East, and thinking in particular of how Hillary Clinton might approach that.
Yeah, the Middle East presents a really complicated challenge for the next president, because the United States essentially from the time when the British left the Gulf that has ended their East of Suez policy back in the 1950s, the United States has steadily become the dominant power in the region, especially after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the eviction of Saddam Hussein's army from Kuwait, talking now about 1991, 92. The United States became the dominant power in the region. And that continued right up to the debacle of the second invasion of Iraq under George W. Bush, when things started to fall apart. And since then, partly because of the pivot to Asia, partly because of the lack of public support for continued engagement in fighting the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the kind of combination led to the United States essentially pulling back from the region, pulling back from its role of dominating the region. And that process, combined with the revolutions in the Arab world, the rise of ungoverned spaces, collapse of institutions, the rise of civil wars, the rise of sectarian wars, to essentially a collapse of the order that we had maintained, increasingly since the 1950s. And there's nobody who can fill that vacuum. You know, the Iranians might aspire to do so, but good luck to that, because there she is, and taking over the Sunni world, that ain't going to happen. They're bumping up against that reality. They can make play between the cracks created by this collapse of the order. They can build on Shia populations in places like Lebanon or Yemen, but they can't dominate the region. They don't have the capability and they don't have the standing in the Sunni world. And, you know, the Russians may send troops to, not even troops really, but forces, some tanks, some aircraft to Syria, but they can't fill the vacuum either. So for the next president, it's going to be a kind of fairly chaotic situation in which, as I said before, the American people are not going to be much interested in spending a lot of blood and treasure in the exercise of establishing dominance there. And so what is the next president to do? We can, on the margins, you know, put in some special forces, embed them with the Iraqi troops, try to sort out our differences with Turkey so that we've got some Turkish forces operating in Syria, figure out who we're going to support on the ground in Syria. That's a tough dilemma in itself. We can get into that if you want to. But, I mean, there's no easy choices. As I said before, we can't rely on the Gulf Arabs to fight against ISIS because they want to fight against the Houthis in Yemen. That's where they're getting sucked into a quagmire. And can't rely on the Turks because the Turks want to fight the Kurds. And the Kurds are the ones that we want to work with against ISIS, right? And the Russians are coming in ostensibly to fight ISIS, but in fact to save Assad, which will just perpetuate the conflict. So it's a mess. And I think it's very hard to figure out what a viable strategy is, other than to just be flexible, agile, see where you can build up support and understand, you know, what your basic purpose is. And I actually talked about this a year ago when I was here, and when I argued that essentially we need a flexible policy in which we got to fight ISIS as if there was no Iran or Assad, and fight Assad and Iran as if there were no ISIS. And that's not a very satisfactory or simple solution, not one that Donald Trump would find particularly attractive. But anything beyond that is, I just don't think that there's a logic to it. So it's a kind of dare I say it, a dual containment strategy. None of you get that reference.
But, yeah, I do. Of course, the one virtue of it being a mess is it means that if it wasn't a mess, I'd have to go out and get a real job. Mr. Lowy.
Welcome again to the Lowy Institute.
Thank you.
Martin, I'm going to be a bit theoretical question. I'm going to the past a little bit. And then maybe that can project to the future, which, of course, I have no answer to that. It's easy to read yesterday's newspaper than tomorrow's. So the two, if I simplify the matter, it's a very complex, but if I try and simplify it, the two major setbacks after the invasion of Iraq for the second time, and then was the one is disbanding the current Iraqi army, and then followed by the long regime of Malaki, the president, the prime minister. These were, I think, the two critical issues, and then followed by some weakness or red line crossing or no crossing by Obama, created this major calamity in the Middle East. I don't know how to project the future, but is it possible to rebuild some part of these three major component of the fall apart of Middle East? Is that possible to rebuild it in some way by making a major commitment to the Iraqi army? And then I don't know whether this current prime minister can bring it together. And a more dynamic of more, rather than that, more forceful American involvement into these three areas. Could the complex Middle East be a little bit less complex?
Yeah. Well, it's a worthy objective to make it a little less complex, because worthy in the sense that it needs that kind of approach, and it needs that kind of humility that we can't reorganize things according to the way that we want them to be, and so we're going to have to work with who we can. In terms of the specifics, yes, Abadi, the new, relatively new Iraqi prime minister, is much better than Maliki, and is certainly under Obama's influence has certainly argued, I should say, presented himself as somebody who is going to seek to be more inclusive and try to bring the Sunnis back in. But he is under the thumb of the Iranians and under their influence. And so there is a strict limit to how far he will go. By the way, one interesting example of that was that when the United States went to him to try to get him to block Russian aircraft from flying across Iraqi territory into Syria with these forces, he said no. He allowed them to do it. Allowed them to do it because the Iranians wanted the Russians to be able to go in there to help protect Assad. So. Yes, he's better, and yes, we can work with him and try to give the Iraqi Sunnis a sense that there is a place for them in the Iraqi political system, but it's always going to be constrained by the fact that he has the Iranians breathing down his neck. There are, other things that we can do there. You said it in terms of building up the Iraqi armed forces, and that's going to take time. That's going to take, the embedding of special forces to fight with them, which Obama's been reluctant to do. I think the next president probably would be more willing to do that. And then it's going to require working with friendly militias. The most important of those at the moment are the Kurds in the north, but they're going to fight in Kurdish territory and on the margins there, particularly they're important to try to retake Mosul, major city in the north. But the Kurds are not going to get far beyond that area. and therefore we are dependent on the Sunni militias. And the problem with getting the Sunni militias to work with us is that they did it twice before. In particular, they did it when General Petraeus, who I understand was speaking here at the Lowy Institute a couple of weeks ago, when he was leading the surge, he managed to get the Sunni militias to join him against al-Qaeda in those days. The Sunni militias today are more reluctant because they felt betrayed by us. As soon as we left, Maliki screwed them and put them out of jobs, and they don't trust the Iraqi government even though it's got a different leader. And they don't trust us because they feel we betrayed them, not once but twice. And so it's going to take some time and effort and, of course, a good deal of money to convince them that they should turn against ISIS. And that's the other part of it. ISIS is brutal in a way that we haven't seen before, at least as brutal as Saddam Hussein and then some. And part of the reason they use those tactics is because they're being advised by Saddam Hussein's generals. Those who have survived are basically working with them. That's part of the reason for their effectiveness. That scares people. That deters people. When they come into a place and chop off the heads of anybody who dares to think about fighting them. So it's to say that it's going to take time, it's going to take determination, and it's not easy to do. But it's not hopeless, it's just difficult. The second related problem is that the border between Iraq and Syria doesn't exist anymore. And if you actually could defeat them in Iraq and push them out of Iraq, they'd go into Syria. And even though we have a plausible strategy in Iraq, we don't have a plausible strategy in Syria. As I started to say, we support the Kurds in Syria, but the Turks, who have now given us an airbase, the better to bomb ISIS in Syria, do not want the Kurds in Syria to establish a kind of autonomous region of their own on the Turkish border, because they fear they'll link up with Turkey's Kurds and the PKK, which they have quite a strong relationship. So there's difficulty there. We don't have a Syrian government in Damascus that we can work with. In fact, we're working against them. And we don't have forces on the ground that we can rely on. And so we tried to train up some, and that turned into a very bad joke. The most competent anti-ISIS forces on the ground are the Nusra Front and their allied militias, the Ahrar al-Sham and a couple of others. Those guys are pretty good at taking on ISIS and Assad, and they're controlling territory now in the north, the Idlib province. As well as in the south, near the Golan Heights. But they're out of al-Qaeda. They're essentially affiliated with al-Qaeda. So who are we going to work with here? General Petraeus actually suggests we should work with them. Maybe he's right. Maybe we can wean them away from al-Qaeda and win them over. But they're the only effective anti-ISIS, anti-Assad force that's available. So it's just full of complexities that require us to do things that seem wrong-headed or unsavory or both in order to have a plausible strategy. So lacking a plausible strategy, even if we could succeed in Iraq, we're not likely to succeed in Syria, and therefore ISIS will continue.
I have a repeat question, just a short question. I hope the answer is for other people. You mentioned the closeness or cooperation between the Iraqi Prime Minister and Iran. I mean, if they would combine together, everything would kind of fall apart. But all these plans that we're talking about here in Washington could be much more, much worse.
Yeah, well, there is...
Is that a possibility?
There is the idea that is out there, and some advocated in Washington, is that the best way to restore some order to this truly chaotic situation is to work with the Iranians. There are some in Tehran who, like the foreign minister, Zarif, who talk about cooperating with the United States. There's some kind of superficial attraction to that idea. Because if they cooperated with us to remove Assad and work out a political solution for Syria, then, you know, we'd have a different situation there. And they have control of the Shia militias in Iraq, and, you know, we could work with them against ISIS. And if they stopped backing the Houthis then in Yemen, then maybe Saudis would have reason to pull out, and you could calm things down there too. So in theory, it's attractive. In practice, it's a mug's game. I don't know whether you agree with this, Anthony, but I don't think that the Iranians, or the Russians for that matter, but particularly not the Iranians, have any interest whatsoever in removing Assad. Because they believe, and they're probably right, since they're smarter at this than we are, that if you take Assad out, the whole house of cards collapses. And it's not just about who rules in Damascus. It's about who rules in the Levant. Because if they lose their position in Damascus, they lose their ability to support Hezbollah in Lebanon. And then they face a real strategic setback, which is, in my view, all the more reason why we should be finding forces to support against Assad, because that would deal the Iranians a real strategic setback. But to cooperate with them is to ensure that Assad will continue. They will not give up on him. And I don't believe they'll give up on anybody else either. In Iraq, cooperate with them is to essentially support Shia militias against the Sunnis. Well, forget about getting the Sunni militias on board at that point. They'll go with ISIS. You cannot defeat ISIS with Shia forces. You have to have Sunni forces. If you try to defeat them with Shia forces with Iran, all you're going to do is generate a much bigger sectarian conflict between Shias and Sunnis. And that's not order, that's more chaos.
My name's Andrew Samuel. I represent nobody but myself.
You're lucky.
I recall my late father, who died in 1958, saying on many occasions that the Americans are very good quitters.
Very good.
Quitters.
Quitters.
You've given us a wonderful spectrum of all the conflicting difficulties. Would it be reasonable to presume from all that that there's a real risk of the USA becoming more and more concentrated on what happens in the USA and less interested in what happens outside the USA?
I think that is certainly something that has some historical precedent in terms of isolationism. But I don't believe that that's what's happening now. And I think it's a mistake to interpret a desire on the part of the American people to get out of the wars in the Middle East and not to get into new ones there. It's a mistake to believe that that is isolationism. I think that Americans have come to understand that in the 21st century we are in an interdependent world. And that the effect of globalization means that there isn't an option of withdrawing from the world. And so I don't see that happening. What I do see is a desire to kind of turn their backs on the Middle East, but engage in other parts of the world. And I think that will be something that manifests itself more clearly in the next administration, with a greater emphasis on Asia and, by the way, a greater emphasis on the forgotten continent, which is the Western Hemisphere, Latin America, which is right close to home. No wars there, no conflicts there. Countries that are growing economically and democratically. So there's a lot of potential in those other parts of the world that I think Americans want to get involved in, including in this region. But the Middle East is like, we had our fingers burnt so badly, and there's nobody can come up with a good solution, a good strategy that actually has a chance of working. So that's what it is. It's confined to, if you like, quitting, to use your phrase, quitting the Middle East.
Martin, we're running out of time, but I want to ask you one Australia-related question. While you've been away, Australia's become the most unstable democracy in the South Pacific. The last three prime ministers have all been replaced in coups. We have a new prime minister who's looking at these kind of range of issues, including Australia's current commitment in Syria and Iraq, but also dealing with the consequences of a rising China. What advice would you be giving him? And where is Australia most useful to the United States? Is it in Syria or is it in helping to shape strategic developments in our own region?
You know, I'm loath to advise an Australian Prime Minister just because I don't know enough anymore about... I used to teach Australian foreign policy, but I've been away from it for too long. That said... I'll give you the American perspective on it, which is Australia remains a very important ally to the United States, and there is bipartisan... That's a bipartisan view in Washington. We might not always give you the attention that you feel you deserve, but it's genuinely understood that Australia is a good ally of the United States. More than that, as we look to this region, given the strength of our alliance with Australia, we look to Australia to advise us. And, you know, as you say, you've got a lot of expertise here at the Lowy Institute, and there's a lot of expertise in Australia more generally, a different perspective to Washington about this region. You're looking at it from down below, and we're looking at it from across a large ocean, and it's different. You look at it differently, and we benefit. I've always thought we benefit a great deal from the Australian perspective on these things, and we look to Australia for that purpose because we know we can rely on you. And so, I think that's really important, especially if you accept what I've been saying about the way in which the United States is. You know, the ship of state moves slowly, but it is definitely shifting its attention to this region, and that makes Australia more important. Is it important to have Australian forces helping us to fight ISIS? Yes, definitely. But that should be understood in the way that we understand it, which is not an attempt to establish, you know, American hegemony in the region. It's an attempt to fight a terrorist organization that is potentially very dangerous. I shouldn't say potentially, actually very dangerous, and Australia has suffered the consequences of the power of ISIS's ideology. And who knows what we're going to see in terms of foreign fighters returning home. So there's a very strong reason for the United States and Australia to cooperate on that counter-terrorism agenda when it comes to trying to contain and eventually defeat ISIS. That happens to be Middle East Pacific because that's where they're trying to set up their caliphate. But it's really about fighting terrorism.
Martin, it may be the case that America benefits from Australia's perspectives, but we've certainly benefited from your perspectives today. It's been a real pleasure to host you once again. We look forward to seeing you back in Australia in the future. Please, ladies and gentlemen, join me in thanking Ambassador Martin. And we'll see you all next time.